And let's move on. It's Friday, so let's move on to our week in review, beginning with continuing concerns about homegrown terrorism. And joining us this week, Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Jeff, good to have you back.
Hey, good to be here.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Welcome to you, Jim. Good to have you.
Good to be with you.
So we just heard about Marine Sergeant Thomas Sullivan of Springfield. He survived two tours of duty in Iraq, only to be gunned down in Tennessee. It follows a big story this week, another big story this week here in Massachusetts about 23-year-old Alexander Chicolo. He's the son of a Boston cop who federal agents arrested in connection with an alleged plot inspired by the Boston Marathon bombers. He allegedly had plans to attack a university. The feds say he had Molotov cocktails. They arrested him for allegedly receiving firearms from an FBI witness. So here's Chicolo talking to investigators after his arrest about his support of the Islamic State.
What do you feel about the group that calls itself ISIS or ISIL? They're doing a good thing?
Yeah, they are. They're doing a good thing.
What's good?
They're implementing the Sharia. They're freeing people from oppression.
So I'm not sure how audible that was, but the FBI investigator asked him, what's good about the group that calls itself ISIS? He says they're implementing the Sharia. They're freeing people from oppression. So, Jim Sturgis, a lot we don't know about this story, but it sort of fits a pattern. The latest example of someone who's apparently inspired by the Islamic State, being influenced by online stuff. What does this case tell you about this ongoing threat and problem here in the U.S.?
Well, just the first thing is our hearts go out to Tommy Sullivan's family. And our thanks go to Alexander Chicolo's dad for what he did. You know what it says to me? There are a couple of there's something deeply troubling, and there's maybe an opportunity here. You know, one of the things that reminds me of every time one of these incidents happens is that after 9/11, it was remarkable to me to see the isolated, very, very isolated incidents of anti-Muslim violence. It really was, there was not a lot. And if this, a similar attack had occurred in many European countries that have larger Muslim populations that are monolithic in nature, like in Britain, they're very, very sort of focused on Pakistanis as well as in France, Algerians, I think it would have been very, very different. But it says something about our attention to and the primacy we give to individuals, we treat people as individuals. The thing that I find really troubling is that when there is a young man, let's say a child who comes to this country as an immigrant and is schooled here, or someone who grew up here from parents who are already born here, they are not attached to this American experiment. They don't feel like there's something exceptional about this country. They're more easily swayed by things that that a young kid could say Sharia law is a fantastic thing, and mm-hmm. they're oppressed is something I find remarkable. That is deeply troubling, and I think all of our schools should recommit to teaching how we got here, why we do what we do, also the warts and all the rest that come along the way. But we need to glue our youth to this American experiment. It is an exceptional sort of purpose that we've created in this country. The opportunity, I think, is this. They are still isolated events. And there are really smart people like Peter Skerry at Boston College who goes around interviewing Muslims to understand how we can integrate them better. And I think we should recognize that we do a far better job of integrating Muslims here in this country than, say, Britain does or France does. In large part because we have dozens of sort of countries of provenance from which they come. So they are not really a separated people in a way, right?
Yeah, and we've got 200 years of immigrant experience probably right. To back up that experience. Jeff Jacoby, what's your response to what happened?
I can't disagree that we should be doing a lot more to promote an attachment to this country and to its ideals and to its values. But I think that we have to get over this nervousness about articulating what should be so clear to us, certainly in the years since 9/11, if not going back to 1979, which is that their war has been declared on our value system by the forces of radical Islam, and it's important to us not only to be able to say so and to be able to screen for radical Islamist sympathies and jihadist tendencies, but also to be able to embrace and to support Islamic reformers, moderate Muslims, who find themselves in a strange position. So often in a strange position of being both shunned by the radicals in the Muslim community and distrusted by many people, who are not Muslims and inclined to think, well, you know, they're all Islamic, so they're all bad. I think it's also worth saying we have now what we saw in Chattanooga yesterday is, you know, it might be an isolated event in the sense of it doesn't happen every day, but this is far from the first attack by a jihadist, or what appears to be a jihadist, on military facilities and military personnel. There was, you know, the most spectacular, most horrible was the Fort Hood shooting, in which how many people were killed? 12 mm-hmm. or 13 people killed. But the Fort Riley attack in Kansas, attacks on the recruiting center in Little Rock.
On this point, we spoke to Seth Jones earlier this week. Doug did, actually. He's director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center, the RAND Corporation, and he tracks this kind of stuff. And he told us something quite alarming, because he had quite a list of these events that have occurred relatively recently. Here's what he said.
In attacks in Copenhagen, Denmark, in Paris, France, in Sydney, Australia, Garland, Texas, Brussels, Belgium, and even Ottawa, Canada, north of the U.S. border. So this pattern is really emerging of these kinds of attacks.
So, I mean, this is beginning to feel like a pretty troubling trend.
I should think so. And I'll tell you, to bring all these threads together, the Boston-based group Americans for Peace and Tolerance produced a documentary a few years ago called Losing Our Sons, and focused on the killing of, I think it was Andy Long was the name of the soldier at the Little Rock, Arkansas Army Recruiting Center. And it told the story of this American kid who was killed and the American kid who got radicalized and adopted radical Islam and killed him. And it follows this trend, and it shows how little seriousness so many people in the government were willing how little importance they attached to it as the evidence was laid before them. It really is very clarifying, and it shows how after all these years after 9/11, there's still such a disinclination on the part of so many Americans to take this threat seriously and realize it's not going to go away by itself. It has to be defeated.
Well, Jim, what do you think? I mean, obviously, this is part of the challenge here has to be confronted by law enforcement. Do you think law enforcement is taking this challenge seriously enough? I mean, what's the response that's missing or that needs to be amped up or what?
Look, I'm no expert in the area. I would say this. Look, there is a lot of monitoring of mosques, right? But I think one of the things that we should recognize in the United States is even though we do have a very disparate set of Muslim populations here, or even people who are converting to Islam, the internet and the internet recruitment is, in addition to how Muslims are integrating, that is something we have to study very closely into as to how people are being recruited and what's a successful strategy for stopping them from being radicalized.
Mm. We are reviewing the week's news here on Radio Boston. Our guests are Jim Sturgis, the executive director of the Pioneer Institute, and Boston Globe columnist Jeff Jacoby. Let's move on to another big story from this week. It's not local, but it certainly started a lot of debate and discussion here in Massachusetts, the U.S. nuclear deal with Iran. This week, we had a series of conversations with members of the state's congressional delegation about the deal, which would limit Tehran's nuclear program for more than a decade in return for lifting international sanctions. Here's Congressman Seth Moulton, who is also a Marine veteran and served 4 tours in Iraq.
I've spent some time fighting in the Middle East, and in Najaf in 2004 and in a couple other places, literally faced off against Iranians. And I want to make sure that whatever we do ensures that we can avoid that in the future, not just in the next couple years, but 10 years from now as well. We have to ensure that Iran does not obtain a nuclear weapon. I think that if we can get a diplomatic solution, it's far better than going to war.
And we also spoke to Congressman Stephen Lynch and Mike Capuano, and both of them expressed some concerns about the deal, but seem to agree that it's better than going to war. Let's start with you, Jim. What's your view of the situation?
Look, I think the how we got here, the sort of how we got here history is really important. And I'd say that if you go back to what the original premise was, it was that we have really crippling sanctions on Iran. We're willing to trade these off for a complete stop to the nuclear program. That's not where we are. There were concessions, and concessions are part of any negotiation. But if you think about it, we went from essentially saying that to a place where we said, okay, you can have nuclear reactors, but no enrichment program. Then we conceded the right to enrich with some limitations. And then we said, we'll put an expiration date to those limitations. I think it's going to be really hard for the American people to understand this deal, where we are, because what Seth Moulton just said was, I don't want them to get the bomb, but what we've just conceded is that within a specific time period, they will have all the material and all the abilities to actually get there, including ballistic missiles after year 8. So this is a really hard sell, and I would say that Congress has the duty to do some real due diligence, and if they need to push back and say you need to go back to the negotiating table and get 1, 2, and 3 done, I think they ought to do that.
Jeff, how do you see it?
The deal was supposed to be dismantle for dismantle. We, the United States, the Western powers, will agree to dismantle the economic sanctions that have been biting Iran only for the last few years, but which were finally biting deeply enough to bring the Iranians to the table. We will dismantle those economic sanctions once you have dismantled your nuclear program. And as Jim lays out, that's far from what's happened. They aren't required to dismantle a single one of their facilities. They aren't required to get rid of all of their centrifuges. They aren't required to get rid of all of their enriched uranium. They aren't even required to submit to what the White House had been promising would be anytime, anywhere inspections. There's been, you know, quite a bit of coverage just in the 2 days since this was announced. Going through the details of this agreement, it's clear that it's not anytime, anywhere, 24/7. Rather, the agreement itself builds in a 24-day stalling period by which Iran can essentially guarantee itself the right to cheat and then to have almost a whole month to cover up the cheating, to get rid of the signs of the cheating. It is a terrible deal. I agree with Congressman Moulton when he says that a diplomatic solution is better than a military solution. The problem is this is not the diplomatic solution. This isn't a solution at all. This is a diplomatic worsening of the problem. It kicks a can slightly down the road, but essentially guarantees Iran's path to a nuclear weapon, which was precisely what the whole procedure was supposed to prevent from Iran.
So how does it guarantee? So here's the one part of what you say I don't understand. How does it guarantee? Because if it provides a 10-year regime of inspection, I mean, I get it that they have 24 days to kind of move things around, but it's not like they can hide a whole bomb program.
The answer, even President Obama has said that if Iran abides by the terms, and I mean, I acknowledge I am highly skeptical that Iran is going to abide by the terms of this deal, since it has never been known to abide faithfully by the terms of any of the deals that it has agreed to in the past. But even the president has acknowledged if Iran abides by these terms, then within 10 to 12 years, the sanctions, all of the restrictions are off. Meanwhile, it gets something like $150 billion in economic sanctions relief almost up front within a matter of a few months. Jim mentioned the lifting of the conventional arms embargo and the ballistic embargo, neither of which was imposed in the first place because of Iran's nuclear program. Those were imposed because of Iran's destabilizing and its terrorism and the other awful activities that it engages in. You only need ballistic missiles if you're going to deliver a nuclear warhead. And yet this agreement provides that in no more than 8 years, even ballistic missile equipment and shipment and purchases are no longer off the table for Iran. So the president was right when he said several weeks ago that if Iran abides by these terms, then its so-called breakout time goes down to zero within a dozen years. And we have every reason to believe, based on the regime's past behavior, that it's not going to wait 12 years. It's going to do whatever kind of cheating is necessary to strengthen its hands and then present the West with another ultimatum, which is exactly what North Korea did. And look where North Korea is now.
There are clearly a lot of concerns, and we can hear the concerns in the voices of even the Democrats. Jim, does this create a difficult position, even though President Obama is on his way out? Is it a difficult position for the Democrats to have these kinds of questions about a really major piece of Obama's legacy?
Look, this would be, if you will, the breakthrough success for President Obama on the foreign policy front. It's going to be extremely difficult for a number of the Democrats to do this. But I do think you still do have a pretty strong group of people like Seth Moulton who will ask the right questions. Look, there are, Jeff was talking about the proclivity for cheating. There's only one tool that I, when reading it, and by no means am I an expert, but in reading, there's only one tool that we have. It's what they call snapback to the sanction regime. The problem with it is, once there are contracts with other folks in different countries to do business, that's going to be those will be grandfathered in. You can't snap back out of those. And what it does is, it locks us into a position where there'll be mid-level and low-level violations all the time because the UN Security Council is not going to call them to the carpet for small violations. It will see that done repeatedly and repeatedly. So I hope they will ask the questions. foreign policy is where politics is always, you know, at water's edge, that's where politics has always ended. That's an adage in American politics, and for very good reason. I hope they live up to their duties.
Jeff, along the same lines in terms of the base, the polls this spring all showed that Americans favor a deal, and there seems to be indications that, you know, that also would indicate that Americans aren't, maybe don't have the stomach for another war in the Middle East or another potential war in the Middle East. Do you see this as a problem for conservatives who are extra hawkish on this? Is that going to put them in a tough position with the general population?
It's clear that there's no general appetite for war in this country, but then there almost is never general appetite for war in this country. That's not the way that decent people normally think. I think that the challenge for conservatives, for Republicans, for hawks, whatever term applies here, is to make the best use of the next 57 days, which is what Congress has before it votes on whether the president can go ahead with these sanctions waivers or not, to make the case that there is a better deal that can be negotiated that doesn't involve a military solution. In other words, a stronger bargaining position, a stronger what they call coercive diplomacy that would undermine the president's claim that it's either this or all-out war. I think that anybody who's serious about the subject knows that that's not the only choice. Barack Obama's famous for his false choices, and I think in the next 57 days, it's the job of national security hawks and conservatives and people who care about the welfare of the world and the future of the United States to make the case that you can have a better deal and it doesn't have to mean going to war.
But, it was really interesting to talk to members of Congress this week because you could really hear the anguish. And these are Democrats we're talking about. You could hear that in Seth Moulton's voice. He had a lot of concerns, but he was also the guy who said, I've been there. I've been to war. I've stared down Iranians. I don't want to subject other folks in this country to this. So, I'm reminded by what Winston Churchill, right, is reputed to have said about democracy. It's the worst form of government except for all the others. And that's sort of the sense I got from talking to these Democrats, members of our congressional delegation, was like, oh, yeah, I mean, this isn't great, but it's so much better than the alternative.
It's worth remembering, just to make the point, that we had at the beginning. The sanctions were imposed and were finally beginning to have an effect. That is what brought Tehran to the table. The great mistake in all of this was the clear desire on the part of the Obama administration to lift those sanctions in order to have a legacy. That, I think, was a terrible mistake. When Jim says that it's going to be awfully hard to make any kind of sanctions snap back once other countries have started to have their own business deals with Iran. That's absolutely true. But it isn't as though we have been forced onto this by an inexorable procession of events. We made a decision, and we're in a tough place now.
All right, well, we've got to move on, and I want to come back a little closer to home and talk about the Boston Redevelopment Authority and the big audit released this week about huge problems at this agency which oversees planning and development in the city. Among those problems, a poor sense of mission and vision, too little transparency, antiquated budgeting procedures, low morale, a cumbersome design and review process that frustrates both developers and neighborhoods. And we spoke yesterday to the director of the BRA, Brian Golden. Here's what he says.
It is truly amazing, isn't it, that in the 21st century, we're still dealing with such deficiencies.
In other words, no argument from Brian Golden. Marty Walsh appointed him to that position just a year ago. Walsh is committed to reforming the BRA. But, Jim, what do you see? I mean, this audit, in a way, wasn't surprising, but it was a no-holes-barred, all-warts-exposed kind of view of the agency.
Yeah, I'd start by saying what I've said before in the air, which is that Brian Golden is a jewel. He is actually an incredible public servant, serious guy who cares a lot. He's already made a lot of changes in the operations of the BRA. And, Mayor Walsh is actually living up to his promise during the campaign that I'm going to pull the thing apart and recreate it. I'd say another thing. We have a lot of international investment money coming to the city. This city's real estate is super hot, and they won't put up with this, is the fact. They don't want to do business with that kind of entity. Look, the fact that they don't have a database of their real estate
holdings—amazing!
It's amazing.
To me, that was the most shocking detail in the entire report.
Look, when I worked in state service, one of the projects we were working on was merging the two entities that were the state park system and the municipal park system into one entity, the Department of Conservation and Recreation. They had no database. They're one of the largest landholders in Massachusetts. This should not shock anybody. The reasons for this, I think, are one: the BRA is self-funded. Therefore, they're insular. They don't need people. They're not transparent in any way. So if they don't have a database, well, who the heck cares? And, you know, the fact is that Mayor Walsh and Brian Golden are trying to change that.
Yeah.
It's a great thing.
And, Jeff, do you think that there is going to be change? I mean, Golden very much acknowledging the problems, Marty Walsh wanting to see reform. Is it going to happen?
I mean, you've always got to deal with the political climate in Massachusetts. But my sense is that there's a real desire not only in the administration, but also on the outside and in the development community to see change happen. The fact that the BRA itself is promoting, essentially posting up on its website this pretty damning report that Brian Golden comes on the air to talk about all the problems there, and that nobody pays even lip service anymore to the idea that Menino somehow, that under Mayor Menino there was somehow excellent management of the BRA. I'd say I find it very encouraging, but I think what everybody needs to hear is something more than just strongly worded promises for reform, and instead some seriously detailed explanation about what changes are going to take place. There appears to be, among other things, a real morale problem at the BRA.
That was a big part of the audit.
Right. Yeah. It talked about how the spirit within the agency is bottom quartile. I think that was the term that they used. Sounds very McKinsey, you know, wonkish. But if people who...
That's what they get paid for.
People who work in the place don't like it. People who have to deal with it on the outside find it impossible to get anywhere. What I would be very interested to see, what I think would be very helpful, would be a major address by Mayor Walsh in which he lays out exactly what has gone wrong at the BRA and stop being so tender about not wanting to sully the pristine legacy of Tom Menino. Let's hear a detailed explanation from the mayor about what went wrong and why at the BRA and how he proposes to move forward from this point to make it better.
All right. Well, we certainly have a pretty clear blueprint about what went wrong, but I agree with you. Now we got to see about how to put it right. So we have very little time, but I want to give you gentlemen some time for your hubbubs, those little stories that never made it to the top of the newscast. And I'm going to try to insist that we do these in about 30 seconds each because the clock is running down. Jim, your hubbub.
Mine's about the BRA. Yesterday, a Boston news site, Universal Hub, reported that the BRA approved a new development called Clippership Wharf in Eastie. It's going to be built on a 12-acre waterfront parcel, a parcel that had no activity for decades. And just to make Jeff's point, under Mayor Menino, nothing moved there forever. So things are changing.
Things are changing. How about you, Jeff?
Well, so Bill Weld was in the back pages of the newspaper today. He's promoting a smartphone app that apparently helps people who are recovering alcoholics. But what struck me most about the story, which was written by Jim O'Sullivan, were some of these quotes from Bill Weld, which showed to me both the best of Weld and the worst of Weld, as I remember the Weld administration 20 years ago.
All right, give us the best.
So he's asked about Charlie Baker, and he says, Charlie Baker's doing a terrific job. He's just like me, except he's a hard worker. Bill Weld always said famously that his great failing was his laziness.
Yeah, and that was commented on quite, not his laziness, but lack of what we should say. What, he wasn't always seen in the corner office anyway. Your hubbub, Doug.
Anthony, I think we can all agree that one thing we don't need in Boston is more New York. But on the set of the new Ghostbusters movie, they have installed a New York subway stop in Boston's financial district. I don't know if this was intentional or not, but the NQR line in New York does not stop at 50th, but it will in Ghostbusters.
It's apparently right in front of my building. We're watching them every day.
It's wrong, right? It's wrong.
It's wrong.
All right, gentlemen. Well, my hubbub is going to have to wait until next week because we're out of
time. We will hold our breath until then.
All right, good. That's
Sorry,
what I
Anthony.
Want you to do. No problem. Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Thank you for coming in. Have a great weekend.
Great to be here.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Always a pleasure. Thank
it's good
you.
Good to see you.
And listeners, stay with us. A lot more show ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Doug Trabue. This is Radio Boston.